Today on Between the Lines, how the movies we see can affect our lives with my guest, the talented actress Ileana Douglas. Welcome, I'm Barry Kibrick. Ileana was discovered by Martin Scorsese and played roles in five of his classic films, including Goodfellas and Cape Fear. Her book, I Blame Dennis Hopper, is a memoir told through the movies she loves, and although very personal to Ileana, her insights will resonate with us all.
I'm a writer today because I was a reader when I was 11 years old. And it was...
You do not need to prove your state of happiness to anybody.
Most of these speeches were as much as a month in preparation.
The characters, the heroes in this book are seekers of truth in a story that involves a lot of corruption.
I don't get a chance to really talk about what's real. And that is the first thing to do.
Ileana, welcome to the show. It is a privilege. After reading this, I kept saying, I've got to meet Ileana. I've got to meet Ileana. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Now, this is, as you say, in the book, you say this is a book about movies. And it really is a book about movies, but it's a memoir as well. And in a sense, it has this universal appeal as I introduce it because we all are affected by not only movies and films, but by TV, by art, and we don't realize the impact sometimes it has on our lives, yet you are extremely attuned to that impact.
Yes, I agree. I think that, you know, people had always said to me, oh, you have great stories, and you're very funny, and your grandfather's Melvin Douglas, and you've got this love of movies, and especially, you know, now with my work with Turner Classic Movies, but I didn't want to tell, didn't want to have a memoir unless it was told through the movies because I really feel as if my whole life, my destiny was formed and shaped by films and specifically, you know, the film Easy Rider, many other films being there with my grandfather. And I had to tell the story through movies, because I don't even remember the dates. I remember things by the films that I saw.
Well, you say Easy Rider. What happens is your dad watches this film, and he literally becomes Dennis Hopper's character. That's what happens in your life. You go from a upper middle-class Connecticut family to this fellow who now looks... He changes his entire appearance and builds a commune in the front yard of the house. And and how else could that but affect your life?
Well, it started with them. You know, they saw the film. And, you know, I must mention in 1969, this was a film that affected America. And the reason that a film like Easy Rider and Dennis Hopper are important is that what it talked about in the movie was freedom. Freedom today means something different. But in 1969, what freedom meant was freedom from money, freedom from the establishment, getting back to the values of the earth. And that's what I think was the whole kind of hippie community. And my parents had just moved to Connecticut basically to start, you know, to have this upper middle class life. And I think that they, you know, they, in the end, they saw this movie and thought, no, there's a better way to live. And at first, you know, this again plunged my childhood into this, you know, Dennis Hopper, Easy Rider childhood with hippies and, you know, musicians and goats and chickens and all. And so what initially it was, you know, as a child, it was pretty alarming. But of course, very much, you know, like a movie, by the time I grew up, became an actress, met Dennis Hopper, had my own kind of epiphany with him. It was, you know, I no longer blame Dennis Hopper. Like, thank God for Dennis Hopper, because in the end, I think I got the better life. I didn't get the life I wanted. And I think that that's what's important. As a child, that was, you know, my destiny was changed by my parents seeing Easy Rider. And I blame them for that for a long time. But in just like a movie, the character, me, comes to the, you know, decision at the end of the film that, you know what, I think I did pretty well.
Well, you know, you say one of the greatest gifts a movie gives us is when we see ourselves. In fact, when I even introduce this book, I say, and you in the show, as the viewers know, I say, You know, this is Ileana's personal memoir, but the fact is we all see ourselves in it. And that's what great art does, is it forces you to see yourself, either reinforcing yourself or seeing where you want yourself to be.
Exactly. And just as that happened to my father, he, you know, in terms of Dennis Hopper's character, I found it happening to me as I was, as much as I could make fun of my parents, this is the movie you change your life over. But then as I became a teenager and watching movies, you know, then I started emulating Liza Minnelli and Richard Dreyfuss and people that gave me courage and confidence.
Well, you have, in the book, what you say is you really are imitating Richard Dreyfuss. When you speak to Richard Dreyfuss, he says all he's doing is imitating Spencer Tracy.
Well, that,
and who
I
knows
know.
Who Spencer Tracy was imitating?
Exactly. And that was the big, again, revelation that when I was working with Richard Dreyfuss, I said, I have a confession to make. When I was in acting school, I didn't know what I was doing. I used to pretend I was you. And he said, oh, well, I was just being Spencer Tracy. So again, it's like you said, we're all emulating these people. And that's why it becomes interesting, this whole, you know, this whole narrative, this whole thread of film history, and why it's so important in our society. And we're just getting at this point where it feels like we're losing that. We're losing that great love of movies, although movies are accessible. We don't have the context of seeing the films and who we were seeing them with.
Well, I'm always a believer that will come back if it's necessary. I know progress oftentimes puts a glitch in things, mm-hmm. and that we don't move linear in that sense,
uh-huh.
but we come back. We don't. We always do. We always. I'll never forget the greatest line was when Aristotle told Plato, he said, you know, by you writing stuff with a pen, you're going to ruin everyone's intellect. So, you know, it really, we think we're losing something, but in the long run, it'll come back. The ease of being able to, in fact, I think it is Packard's son, David mm-hmm. Packard, is now creating the greatest collection of celluloid and storing it properly so people mm-hmm. can still view it.
But isn't there that sense memory, though? Because, you know, I devoted a whole chapter to drive-ins. And drive-ins for me were not only the film, they were a social experience. It was where kids got together, you know, to be away from their parents and watch movies that they weren't supposed to be seeing, with a lot of nudity and kind of discovering things on their own. And my first experience watching a movie was very seminal, because I'm in a drive-in in Vermont. I'm in a car with Melvin Douglas, who's a movie star, who smells great, who looks great, who drives a 1959 Mercedes convertible. And so it was the sense memory of not only seeing a romantic film like Romeo and Juliet and seeing nudity, but I also think it's the sense memory of leaning next to my grandfather and the glamorous feeling that was.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm now a grandparent myself, and my youngest granddaughter, actually, my youngest granddaughter was just born, but my young granddaughter, she said to me just the other day, and she's only 3 and a half, and she said, Grandpa, do you remember when you took me to that Orange Park and we sang that song?
Aww.
So I do believe, you see, that's what I'm saying. I have to believe that it still goes on. But, and I'll tell you why I think, it's from your own book. What your own grandpa, Melvin Douglas, said. And he told you, when you find someone you can learn from, hold on to them. Mm. And I believe that we still today, even at the youngest of ages, with sense of memory, mm-hmm. is happening, because we have to, and mm-hmm. therefore we will.
Yes. And I always took that, you know, that advice to heart, and it was as if a little bell would go off sometimes when I would meet people or I would have an experience. And it wasn't so much about, for me, about becoming successful. It was about taking opportunities to learn.
Well, you know, you quote, in fact, Mike Nichols, mm-hmm. who tells you that, well, he tells you many things, but the thing that caught my eye was, the only safe thing is to take chance. Play safe and you're dead. And Ileana, I thought when he said that, and then I started continuing to read, I said, talk about someone who really followed that advice, because you never play it safe. You always take that chance. You always, and you're also very much aware of whatever sign or coincidence may lead you to something. And sometimes a coincidence, as Freud said, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Sometimes a coincidence is just a coincidence. But when it strings together, there's a sign, and you seem to be able to tap into
that. I wasn't always aware of it, but again, that rebellious nature, I began to believe, came from my upbringing, came from feeling as if I'm the child of Dennis Hopper. I'm both really and then cinematically the child of Dennis Hopper. I went into independent films, and Easy Rider was this independent film. But things, started to make sense. Like a movie, you started to see these coincidences of, wait a minute, this seems odd. I'm watching movies with Lee Marvin. Now I'm meeting Lee Marvin. And it dawns on you after a while. I mean, at first when you're young, I think you're just trying to move ahead and become successful. But even I would have to say that the amount of cinematic coincidences I've had have certainly piled up.
Well, you use this term. You say I've always stumbled towards success. So these coincidences kept happening. But here's what I noticed, and I'll finish the sentence. But I also learned the joy, the discipline, the hard work of performing. And I couldn't help but I made the first time I saw the word joy, I made a little mark. Throughout the book, the word joy appears, and there's something about that only now I'm beginning to even realize its importance. To do things with joy makes all the difference in the world. And you always did it with joy. Maybe you had to fight through depression. I don't know. Maybe you had to struggle through anxiety. But joy was still the end result.
Absolutely. And again, I think that is something that it's as if a little angel tapped me on my shoulder, sitting, next to Hal Ashby when I was a child, not even knowing he was Hal Ashby, watching Peter Sellers, watching my grandfather and Jack Warden, and watching these people. And I was watching them like a movie. It was my first experience of being on a film set and understanding that, a large group of people make a film. And they were having so much fun. And again, it seemed like this private place that the world didn't know about. And they were so joyful in making, in making this film. And it stayed with me. Those experiences stayed with me of trying to experience joy. And remember, it's Roddy McDowall who says to me when I'm going through, because I certainly did have my challenges and stumbling and, people told me, I didn't look the way I was supposed to look. You don't sound the way you're supposed to look. But then somebody like Roddy McDowall, who's in his 60s, says to me, Marilyn, he could not find joy in her work. And he said, the business is about people will try to kill that joy in you. And somebody like Martin Scorsese, who I was in a relationship with at the time, he said, he's beyond feeling any joy in his work. And that just hit me of that, here's this person, Roddy McDowall, and wow, if he feels that way, he's a trooper, he's out there, he's auditioning for movies in his 60s. And that had a real impression on me. So every time I got sort of full of myself or wasn't enjoying myself, it's as if somebody came down from the movie screen to help me on my own personal journey.
Well, let's talk about that. You mentioned Martin Scorsese, and in a sense, he discovers you by, again, serendipity and coincidence.
Yes.
And you do have a relatively long-term relationship with him. And he says this thing that I think sums up, after reading this, a lot about you. He says, I think the problem you're going to have in your career is that you're always going to be more interesting than your material. And as I was reading this, I said, my gosh, Ileana really is more interesting. I could see how that's hard to cast someone even. And yet you've been in many films and in some of his greatest films, from Goodfellas to Cape Fear to all these others. But yet I can see that they almost have to taper it around you, because you have a strong sense of your own joy, a strong sense of your own self. And that's a very interesting dynamic for an actress to have.
Yes. It was an astute, observation that I found frustrating at the time, because it meant that I think everybody starts out, at least I did, that I just wanted to be on movies and having somebody bring me lattes and have a lot of fun. But it's like, no, Ileana, your life is going to be all about learning a lot of things, struggling, possibly expressing something more. Because I think of myself as a very lazy person. I just, I climb.
Oh, that's hard. That is hard. Well, it's not hard to believe that a person would think of themselves that way, because we don't oftentimes really think of ourselves the way we are. I know many of the thoughts of myself, when I tell them to my wife or my son, they go, "You've got to be kidding me. You're just the opposite." But yet it seems funny when I read that to think of you as lazy because of all the work you do.
Yes. And the reason I used a phrase like stumbling towards success was because it always seemed that, I'm hanging out with my grandfather and, we're on this, on the set of Ghost Story, and he's to have me, and I'm meeting John Houseman, and we're talking about how I'm going to be going to Juilliard and living with my grandfather. And then my grandfather passes away, the rug's pulled out from under me, and I got to start all over again. So all these life experiences were like, God damn it, this is going to make me a really interesting person. But I always wanted to eat, I would have preferred to just have the fun, easy life. That was not the journey that I was on. And again, somebody like Marty, because I would be auditioning for things and always coming in second. But it led me to develop my own material.
You worked. One of the things you love is, as you say, when you're watching a film and you feel the director knows you, even if you're just viewing it. And one of them that really does seem to know you is Gus Van Sant. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he instilled to you is the importance of trust. But he said this because, again, I think he was aware of that uniqueness, and he painted you a little picture of flying saucers or something like that. But I remember the words. I have the quote: "Be your own flying saucer and rescue yourself." And you said that became your motto.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Every person that came in my path was telling me, in order to accomplish something, you're going to have to be more than just an actress. You're not going to be able to accomplish the messages that we feel. They were seeing something in me that I couldn't see in myself. And so again, when he said, "Be your own flying saucer, rescue yourself," it was as if I was leading myself on this journey of more writing, more directing, more expressing myself.
Joseph M. Wanted with the Constitutionalist Politics. Tune in for the upcoming episode for May 4, Issue Never the Issue, as well as guests Peter Serafin, Rosemary Downer, Don Gallade, Gista the Rapper, Cy Young, Jason Perry, and upcoming Jack Hagar, Andrew Thorpe King, Trent Rock, Ed Temple, Chris Morehouse, and more. Please tune in to Constitutionalist Politics. God bless.
Now, classic scene in the book is Marlon Brando, you and Martin Scorsese having lunch. And I'm not going to even give it away because it's about the funniest thing you can read, especially... I'm not going to go that. But I am going to play off of what you just said.
Yes.
Because one of the things that Brando tells you, that again, he says to you, you're a tuning fork. And right then and there, again, the light bulb goes off.
Yeah. And I got just deeply emotional. I burst out, crying. It was as if Marlon Brando... because I thought of him as the world's greatest actor. I had posters of him, pictures of in my room. My acting teacher, Sanford Meisner, talked about him being the greatest living actor of all time. I mean, we studied his films, we watched his films. And as I said, I didn't want to meet him because I just thought, I can't even be in the room with some. It's too real. Movies, for me, I want them to remain cinematic. And so by meeting him, would it just even shatter my own, you know, my own movie that was in my head? But, of course, I met him, and then here the world's greatest actor picks up that I'm insecure, that I'm, that I have low self-esteem, that I don't feel good about myself. And it becomes its own sort of inner journey with me of having Marlon Brando being, you know, I start to cry, then he starts to cry, then it becomes this just like really as if you're, you know, in an acting class. Suddenly everything became like really, really real. And again, it was that reminder that you are valuable. But I needed somebody from the movies. I needed Marlon Brando to say that to me. I couldn't do it for myself.
Isn't that something? Because, in fact, right before he comes, you keep trying to tell Marty, I don't want to meet him. I'm too, like you said, I was too in shock. And he says, just be yourself, just be yourself. And then you have this little Bacchanalian feast. And I have to give away this one little line. I'm just because it's so funny. He comes in at this time. Marlon was at his heaviest.
Yes.
And he didn't want to go out. He wanted to order room service because he was a little bit embarrassed by his weight. And the minute I'm thinking that what's going to be coming is broccoli and celery and salads, and it is a feast ordered up of at least 2 to 3 things of everything on the menu and as much wine and champagne as was basically in the hotel.
And that was just lunch.
That was just lunch.
And, and then it launched into dinner. And then by midnight, you know, when he he would have spent the night. He would have spent the night. But finally, you know, and I love the scene, too, of when he was finally left. Of here, you've got this great director, Martin Scorsese. And we were like cartoon characters. We couldn't talk with the behind the door, like, is he gone? You know, we were so afraid to talk because we thought he's going to want to come back in and spend the night and keep eating with us. We were, you know, we couldn't eat anymore, drink anymore.
It's a great. And by the way, I realize now, as I'm thinking of the scene, I gave away nothing. I just gave the taste. So wait till people read it. But you know, again, we go back to the film, and to you realize though again, and there's joy, but the stress of filmmaking. And you say to me, a movie is like a roulette wheel with a series of problems where the numbers should be. So no matter what you're going to spin, no matter where it's going to land, there's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
That's all. And every movie has it.
Yeah. And you never know what it can be. You could plan, every potential disaster that you think is going to happen. And then the one thing is, you're doing a scene and then they say, who was the person who was supposed to check that we're not in a flight pattern? You know, and you just never know. You never know what it's going to be. And so there's a certain, you know, when we did Alive, the call sheet was 6 pages long. We never could complete a scene because the weather kept changing. And so you had to be able to adapt. Sometimes you work with people and they don't want to work with you off camera. Sometimes somebody who you think is going to be unpleasant turns out to be the nicest person in the world. Sometimes, you know, again, you're working with someone you idolize, like Vanessa Redgrave. And guess what? She and the director don't get along. They've got a history. And so something that you think is going to be, well, this is going to be incredible, ends up being like the most yelling and screaming I've ever experienced on a movie, you know?
Well, but then what you realize is, and I guess it started off with your Twitter handle, actually, now, Ileana Rama. And you say these words, who knew the best role I ever played will turn out to be myself?
Mm-hmm. And again, it goes back to what all these people were telling me, what Martin Scorsese was telling me. He's saying, you know, what you're going to have to do is be yourself. And for me as an actor, and I don't know if other actors feel this way, the last thing I wanted to be was myself. That's why I got into acting. I wanted to be anybody else but me. Because me was the kid who grew up on a commune, the kid that got, you know, bullied for being a hippie, the kid who never had any money, you know, the kid whose mom said, you know, well, today, what do you want? Peanut butter or jelly? So it was all those things that I was so horrified by. I'm like, I don't want to be me. And yet it was finally leading me into that, you know, direction of like, well, okay, you got to be yourself. And once I was myself, the whole world opened up to me. It was really interesting as a writer, as a director. Once I embraced kind of who I was, where I'd come from, my whole ability to write and act suddenly changed.
Well, I, for one, am very grateful you found yourself and you joined us today, Ileana. I'm going to end with these words from your book. Life is a state of mind. That's the last line from Being There. You can believe that or you cannot believe it. I choose to believe in chance encounters, and I am very grateful to have this chance encounter with you, dear Ileana.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's been a pleasure.
It's my pleasure, and thank you all for joining us. Now, before Ileana leaves, I'd like to leave you with these few more words from I Blame Dennis Hopper and Other Stories from a Life Lived in and Out of the Movies. A show is a show is a show. All that was left of it were the echoes of the applause. If you could somehow keep that sound, that joy as we spoke about earlier, to remind you of why you're put on the planet, it's to entertain people and to make them happy for just a little while. I'm Barry Kibrick. Between a life lived inside or outside of the movies, we are all put on this planet to make people happy, even if it is just for a little while. Thank you so much, Ileana.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast and want to hear more, please subscribe or become a patron of the show at barrykibrick.com to keep it going every week. Thank you.